C4. Number 11A.
When we study the chapter on prayer, and if we feel that we have found out the core of that whole pedal note of prayer, that prayer has to do with inward unity with the nature of God, so that if mind is within us, that then we are one with that mind, which also manifests itself to us as mind. We could think, is that not enough? What more can we have but to be inwardly at one with mind and have the blessings of mind? So what else could there be? But if you read in the chapter on prayer how far prayer goes, we come, for instance, to this statement where Mrs. Eddy says, prayer cannot change the unalterable truth, nor can prayer alone give us an understanding of truth. Do you see what she says? She says prayer has somehow a limitation, because prayer alone, prayer alone, without something else, can give us an understanding of truth. Apparently there is much more necessary than just prayer. Apparently another attitude has to be cultured within us so that finally we will understand truth. And from yesterday's matrix we know that only in the fourth chapter, the chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism, she would show, or we would learn, how to understand truth. She goes on and says, but prayer, coupled with a fervent habitual desire to know and to do the will of God, will bring us into all truth. She indicates what is the next step that will bring us into all truth, meaning that prayer alone does not bring us into all truth, that prayer is only somehow a starting point, a proposition from which to go out, but that there is more necessary. And what she indicates is that the desire must be coupled with the will to do the will of God. That prayer alone is not enough, that action, doing, is necessary. She even says, a great sacrifice of material things must precede this advanced spiritual understanding. Can you see how in these sentences this somehow gives spiritual order? She says, prayer alone cannot give us an understanding of truth. Apparently, understanding of truth comes afterwards, sometime afterwards, after prayer. She also says, that which brings us there is not only desire, but also to do the will. Apparently, after prayer, there must come something that has to do with doing, with action, before we arrive at an understanding of truth. Or she even says, a great sacrifice of material things must precede this advanced spiritual understanding. As she says, before you get to understanding, which we know comes round about the fourth chapter, before you get there, you have to sacrifice material things. A great sacrifice has to be made, so that one feels after prayer must come something more. Must come something that has to do with doing things, with sacrificing the wrong sense of things, and that only then afterwards we are ushered into an understanding of truth. And this is exactly what she wants to show with the next chapter, with Atonement and Eucharist, that actually that chapter Atonement and Eucharist says what is necessary now is to do things, to get up from your knees and act, do something about it, not just always pray and pray and pray, because that is only happening within your mentality, But that prayer should also be something that exemplifies itself in works and in deeds and in action. And those actions are what kind of actions? He says those kind of actions should show forth a great sacrifice of all that is not God-like, that is not of the nature of God. In other words, you can't take it with you. You can't take error with you and get into heaven. You can't pray and something within you still leans on material basis, still leans towards material affection, towards egotistical aims and the fulfillment of ulterior motives and so on. You have to lay down everything which is not of the nature of God. You remember what we did yesterday when we came to the Word as the Christ? We said, in the Word as the Word, we see that we go out from the presupposition that we have the nature of God within us. Then the Word as the Christ, we said, therefore the Christ demands that we overcome the God-unlike nature within us. We cannot try to go into perfection with both the God-like nature in us and the God-unlike nature in us. The greater has to overcome the lesser. The God-like nature has to overcome the God-unlike nature, or else we cannot make any progress. This is Atonement and Eucharist. If we read Atonement and Eucharist, we see right from the beginning that now there comes in that sense of action, of proving, of living, and living according to prayer, and therefore overcoming all that which is contrary to God's nature. Look at the very first statement or sentence in that chapter of Atonement and Eucharist. Says, Atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God. Can you see spiritual order? The chapter on prayer said prayer has as its aim what? Man's unity with God. Atonement and Eucharist says, exemplify that. Yes, you can go out from man's unity with God, but you must exemplify it, whereby man reflects divine truth, life, and love. So atonement is defined here as the exemplification of prayer. In order to exemplify that, naturally we need that atonement, the atoning with the nature of God. It is not the atonement of God and man, because God and man are always at one. There is no need for atonement, no need for the process of atoning. God and man are atoned, are one, but atonement is the approach that we have, that we make to reconcile man to God. How can we reconcile man with God? We can only reconcile man with God by laying down everything that is not God-like. That's as simple as that. And Atonement and Eucharist tells us all about how to overcome that which is God-unlike. This overcoming of what is God-unlike is really the Eucharist. Atonement is the process of atoning, getting nearer and nearer to the nature of God. Eucharist is the willingness to lay down the God-unlike. That's why we have these two terms in the chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, because Atonement is saying, showing the unity of God with of man with God, which demands as an exemplification that we lay down the God-unlike. And naturally, the laying down of the God-unlike nature is that which is very hard for the human. That's the crux of the whole thing. And therefore that chapter is full, really, of rather depressing aspects. It is in this chapter where She said it takes Jesus' life and crucifixion and resurrection and so on as an example for that laying down of the mortal sense of life. And so here we have quite a few mournful occasions. She says that the Last Supper was a sad supper, a mournful occasion. The whole text is full of telling us that there is no immediate reward, that persecution and misinterpretation takes place, that we have to deal with jealousy, with envy, with hate, with cruelty, with ignorance. Can you see? It is a hard chapter. It is a sad chapter, a sad occasion, a mournful occasion. Mournful because it's only mournful for the human, not for the divine. The human has to yield. And that is why this chapter gives us all those great demands of the Christ. The demands of the Christ to lay down all that which wants to oppose our unity with God's nature. We have in here those statements which say that the divine must overcome the human at every point. Can you hear that tone of the divine in us must overcome the human in us? It is there, it is here in this chapter where Mrs. Eddy says the that the divinity of the Christ was made manifest in the humanity of Jesus. See, as he was overcoming the divine, the human with the divine, he was bringing out in the human more and more the divine. The scriptural note at the beginning of the chapter hints already to that. It reads, "They that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts." And you see, those that are Christ's, we are in the Word as the Christ, those that have the Christ nature, they must jolly well do something, namely to crucify what? The flesh with the affections and lusts. When the Bible speaks about the flesh and the lusts of the flesh, the affection of the flesh, it doesn't just mean sexuality or sensuality. It really means all those attributes that we attribute to a material leaning, to a material affection. It is not just the sensual that is meant by it, but what is meant by it, that we have to crucify what? The counterfeit of mind, the counterfeit of spirit, the counterfeit of soul, the counterfeit of principle and of life and of truth and of love. That's the flesh in the biblical terminology, and the flesh with the affections and lusts. So that we have to get away just from thinking in a moral way, but much more in that scientifically spiritual way, where we can see that every idea, every truth must be victorious over its counterfeit. And this is the content of this chapter. So, in other words, the chapter shows there is no atonement, really, without the Eucharist. The Eucharist is a prerequisite, so to say, for atonement. Naturally, Mrs. Eddy takes up various false concepts of theology about the Eucharist, showing that it is not so that Jesus has brought about the reconciliation for the whole world, that he has borne our sins for the whole world, and therefore we don't have any more to go through the atonement and Eucharist. What Jesus meant, what the Bible meant, is that Jesus showed to the whole world that there is a way of atonement, that he has taken up every phase of mortal mind, every phase of the world, and has shown that he can overcome it, and that it is possible to overcome, but that there is no vicarious atonement. Each one has to do it by himself. We can't just say, well, Jesus did it for the world. He has taken away the sins of the world. He hasn't taken away the sins of the world, by no means. We only have to look around and then we know that he hasn't taken it away. But he has taken away the sins of the world in his own experience. There he has done it. And has shown as an exemplar that it can be done and how it can be done. So we have in Jesus' life work an example that it can be done. That's why the chapter starts, atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God. And then shows how Jesus did it and showed it and exemplified it. And how Jesus said, what I can do, you can do. What I can do, all can do. It's open to everybody. So I have set the example, do it as I did it. So we have to follow that rule, those methods, and see that there is no atonement really without that Eucharist. If we have seen the tonality of this chapter, that the divine must overcome the human at every point, then we can say, what is the divine? What is the human? If we take the seven synonymous term, then we say, well, the divine, the nature of mind has to overcome the nature of mortal mind. The nature of spirit has to overcome the nature of matter. The nature of soul has to overcome the nature of physical sense testimony, of sin, of physical sense. And so each synonymous term within us can overcome its counterfeit belief. That would be Eucharist. And that Eucharist would finally leave us to the point where we feel at one. This is the at-one-ment. You have in your English language that wonderful possibility of taking the term atonement and vary it into at-one-ment. Wonderful way of doing it. We can't do it in German, so it doesn't play the trick in our language, but it's a beautiful way of showing that atonement is a process of atoning, whereas the end product is to be at one mind, that we are meant to be at one, at one meant. So at one meant is the final achievement through atonement. Mrs. Eddy presents this whole question in her second chapter, taking Jesus as an exemplar, and therefore takes out of the Bible always those examples which fit into her order of presenting the subject. Therefore, we do not find in the chapter as a whole, Jesus' life story. Only at a certain point, which I will point out, we find Jesus' life story in a chronological way. Else, she only takes those examples from the Bible which are fitted to exemplify her teaching. Let's take our epitomes. You have written them out on the page. If you have them in front of you, I can much easier run through them. What is atonement and what is Eucharist from the point of view of mind? From the point of view of mind, demands right and courageous action. Mind acts. But here it is brought down to the human, namely that we have to act courageously, that we have to act constantly in the line of atonement, in the line of the law of atonement. Can you see what is shown here is that it says you can't always stay there where you pray mentally, where in your mind you turn over those beautiful concepts of what is divine mind and molding your thought and your mentality according to the great definition of mind in its seven big subtones. You also have to go out into the world and act according to it. You can't have a dualistic sense within you where you say, I'm thinking all right, but then I have to go out into the world and then I have to act according to the world. This was Jesus' great courageous enterprise, that he was acting in the world according to his inward mental attitude. That is why Jesus acted boldly. You feel, does that need courage? Does that need boldness to act in the world according to the divine? Yes, it needs. It needs terrific courage because the whole world does not act according to the divine. And therefore, one is always an outsider, and one is right from the beginning a pioneer, an outsider, a dissenter, an outcast, somebody who is not understood, who is not going with the mob, he's a loner, and all that. He has to act according to a system of reference which is not accepted by the world. And so it needs courage to stand up for one's ideal. Actually, it should not be should not need courage to act according to God. It should be the most natural thing. But here you can see why it needs courage, because here the divine has to overcome the human. She's not teaching the absolute sense of divine action. She's showing what the divine action of mind, what the impact is on the human. And there we have to stand up against the mentality of the world, mind. In spirit, we can see now how the divine has to overcome the human. It is a great sense of purification that takes place. We have said here, atonement demands purity of thought. That spirit, purity of thought, demands therefore turning away from matter to the imperishable things of spirit. You see the tone of spirit, always that distinction. When we turn away from matter and turn towards the spirit, we make a line of demarcation in the human so as to purify our consciousness. Spirit is purity. Can you see that it demands that courageous action which says, I'm turning away from the material system of reference, and I turn to the spiritual and to the only spiritual, to turn away from matter, to turn towards the imperishable things of spirit. It is here where she said, thou shalt have no other gods before you. Can you hear the onlyness of spirit? It's here where she says, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things are God's. Again, separating. Give to Caesar what he wants, but give to God what belongs to God. Again, a separation in the human. Can you see what atonement and Eucharist is here in spirit? To make that distinction, make the clear cut, know that you turn away from the material sense of thinking and turn to the spiritual reality of things and trust in the spiritual reality of things. Then we come to soul, terrific, beautiful sense there, when one reads it. The epitome here is atonement demands going the way from sense to soul. You know that is a tone, a characteristic of soul, that it takes us from sense to soul. It's the way from sense to soul. It's the way out of darkness into the light. You have to go that way from sense to soul. But to go that way from sense to soul always meets opposition, always meets the opposition of everything, the opposition of the mortal mind, meets the opposition of material affection, meets the opposition of the carnal mind and of malicious mind, meets the opposition of theories, meets the opposition of persecution, it meets opposition and opposition and opposition, because the human is always opposed to the divine. Therefore, soul demands to be a sticker, not to give in. Here we get a sense of soul, that soul is very sincere, it's not enough, is perseverant, that soul never gives in. It's so definite that it doesn't waver. And you just, when you read those passages there, they are just full of those qualities which we have to have humanly in order to be able to overcome with the divine the human. It is all to be very resolute, very persevering, very persistent, very definite, very firm, very constant. Can you hear soul? These are all qualities of soul, huh? Where it says, occupy till I come, don't give in, huh? Be not weary in well-doing, be not weary, don't give in, huh? Go not back to error, don't be discouraged, huh? Don't go back. If you have started and you don't get your result right away, don't give in, don't think it's wrong, and therefore go back to the flesh pots of Egypt again. Don't give in. Don't go back. Go forward. That's the way from sense to soul. Huh? Don't become a sluggard in the race. When things are going too well, we become a sluggard in the race. That's why periods where things just go fine, that's very dangerous. Huh? That's very dangerous when things go fine. Huh? Then we have to be careful. When things are rugged, they are the beautiful periods. They are the strong periods. They are the real periods where you make progress. You see? You see? You don't want the Eucharist, huh? You rebel against the Eucharist, huh? You like to have it fine, huh? Yeah? Yes, we like it. I know we like it. The human likes it, huh? But the divine wants to purify and wants to purify. Yes. All right. We just see here, huh? You read those passages, they are terrific, you know. Just say, be a sticker, huh? Don't give in, don't anymore give in. Once you have set your goal, go on it, huh?